That song is called The East is Red, and it was China's de facto national anthem during the Cultural Revolution. From about 1966 to 1976, China's leader Mao Zedong enforced a brutal agenda. Everything was rationed. Millions of people were forced out of the cities and into the countryside, where food was even more scarce. The government controlled people's movements, their livelihoods, even their thoughts. And everything was propaganda, posters, clothing, songs.
The East is red, the sun has risen, China has given rise to a Mao Zedong.
Scott Seligman is a Washington, D.C. writer who lived for several years in China.
On behalf of the people, he has brought good fortune to the people. He is the great savior of the people.
The original song was actually about love and food.
That's Sasha Gong, a former Chinese political dissident and Scott's friend.
It was about cabbage hearts, as a matter of fact. And then a very patriotic, somewhat obsequious Chinese man wrote new lyrics to it that sang the praises of Chairman Mao.
Sasha and Scott met several years ago and collaborated on writing projects. When they would get together, they ended up in Scott's kitchen, cooking and talking about Sasha's experience growing up during the Cultural Revolution. At one point, Scott suggested the two of them turn her memories and culinary skills into a book, The Cultural Revolution Cookbook.
She thought I was crazy.
I said, those are painful memories to me. But as long as I can add some stories in it, yeah.
Sasha has lived in the U.S. since 1987, and she got a Ph.D. from Harvard. But her childhood in China was a hard one.
I was 10 when the Cultural Revolution was launched. My grandfather was accused of being a counter-revolutionary, so I was sent to countryside living in the village.
Sasha and her family worked on farms, but the food all went to the government. Her family, like so many others, was left to fend for itself, and Sasha learned to cook with whatever she could find. In the cookbook, she shares the peasant recipes of that time and how food kept families together despite a revolution that was pulling them apart.
We're making no apologies for the Cultural Revolution in this book. It was a horrible time. A lot of people suffered. This is a celebration of the people who triumphed through this horrible time when there wasn't enough food and there wasn't freedom and all those awful things were happening. But somehow they managed to make do with what they had. They made remarkably tasty dishes with very, very basic and rudimentary materials and ingredients.
Ingredients anyone can get. No need to find a specialty Chinese market. These culinary delights are as close as your local supermarket. Sasha and Scott take me shopping for ingredients to cook up three classic Chinese dishes.
All right, let's grab a cart.
Okay, we need scallions and cilantro.
Tofu.
I think we're going for pork shoulder now.
Just get the soy sauce, any soy sauce.
Ginger.
Sesame oil.
Eggs.
We don't need to buy sugar. We don't need to buy salt. And we don't need to buy a stick of cinnamon, but we need some wine.
And Coca-Cola. That's it. How much was it?
$40.97.
So for $40, not bad.
And the meal will feed about six people. And with that, we're off to Scott's apartment to put their simple recipes to the test.
All right, so what tools do we need to cook?
Well, actually, there's a cookbook out there that has something like 40 pages devoted to how to select, season, and choose a wok. We have about a paragraph on that, because in the countryside, you cooked with it whatever the hell you had.
Yeah.
We actually are going to use a flat-bottom pan today as well as a wok. It's really not that big a deal.
Remind us what we're cooking today, Sasha.
Actually, we are cooking braised pork.
With soy sauce.
With soy sauce.
And now I'm going to cut up the meat.
Okay.
This is pork shoulder, very much marbled. So, cut it through. Cut it through. See? Very easy to cut it through.
Kind of big chunks.
Big chunks.
Next, Sasha takes a large ginger root, skin on, and places it on the counter. She smashes it with the side of her meat cleaver.
Now, you turn on the stove. The pork is fatty, so you don't need much oil, but you do need oil to, smooth the pan.
Sasha then drops the ginger in the pan, and a sweet aroma fills the kitchen. And then In goes the pork to sear. Then she adds sugar, soy sauce, rice wine, and a stick of cinnamon.
And then we turn the fire into low medium and let it cook.
How long does it cook for?
About 45 minutes. And it's important not to spend too much time.
That was important in selecting these dishes. You wanted them to be things that were easy?
Chinese restaurant food, a lot of what you see here in the United States, even at better Chinese restaurants, is a much prissier operation than this. This was country cooking. This was get it in the pot and heat it up and get it in everybody so that they've got enough strength to go work in the fields.
Yeah. And still tasty.
Right.
And this, we should say, you write in the book, was Chairman Mao's favorite dish?
Oh, yes. And Mao developed the habit when he was commanding the army in the Civil War. He believed meat was good for your brain. So each time he was before a big battle, said, okay, cook me the braised meat with soy sauce and I need my brain food.
Chairman Mao's brain food is now nice and tender, and Sasha takes it off the stove. She piles a heaping mound of the braised pork into a big blue and white bowl.
All right. Finished. That's it. Done.
We get to eat now, right?
We get
yes.
to eat.
Who would like something to drink?
Tofu and egg custard are also served. Then we take our seats at the table and dig in.
Let's do it. Oh, we each have chopsticks. Okay.
Yep. Let me have your rice bowl.
We start with an egg custard that Sasha remembers from her childhood.
It's great. It's really savory. It's really light.
Thank you.
The texture's perfect.
It's just egg and the water and the salt and a little bit sesame oil, nothing else.
Okay, I'm going for the pork.
Now, which is which?
Sasha prepared two versions. The first was the traditional pork braised with soy sauce and rice wine, topped with cilantro.
Oh, that is so nice.
Thank you.
The second version was made with Coca-Cola, which Sasha says is a fine substitute if you can't find rice wine.
Different.
Different.
Tastes different than the other one.
Mm-hmm.
I gotta say, I like the traditional one better. Because am I allowed to have more?
Yes.
Okay, good.
It's a meal Sasha Gong has made hundreds of times before.
When you sit down and you eat this food now, in 2012, what do you think of? What images come to mind?
Well, family time.
Mm-hmm.
When you have that much food, you have family and friends coming in. It's something about humanity. It's hard to suppress. You want friendship, love, and...
And you want pork.
And you want pork.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, gosh, we were hungry. Well, hungry. In that time, you know, how government tried to prevent people from gathering. And if you have 3 or 4 people gathering, might be anti-government activity. You know, when people gather, over food.
This is such a painful time. I don't imagine there are a lot of fond memories that you associate with this period of time. Focusing on it, writing a book about it, must have been strange.
Well, it's... I went through a lot of bad time. But you know, one thing about human beings, they always survive and celebrate life. And food is one of the major ways to do that.
There's a complicated sense of nostalgia in her recollections of that chapter. Scott says that's not unusual for her generation, now far enough away from the Cultural Revolution to look back on the small moments worth remembering.
In the last 20 years or so, China has seen a resurgence in some ways of interest in the Cultural Revolution. There are Cultural Revolution-themed restaurants in just about any large city in China. And these are places where people who were sent down to the countryside go, in some cases to have reunions with others who were sent to the same places. And they relive their past. It's not a happy past entirely, but that's really not the point. It's their past.
Well, thank you very much for cooking with me and sharing this part of your history with me. Thank you to Scott.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Letting us into your home.
Oh, it's my great pleasure.
Before we leave, we ask Sasha if she remembers any of the music from that era. She says yes. That song, The East is Red, is seared into her memory. But she refuses to sing the communist lyrics. She wants to sing us the original version about love and food. Again, Sasha Gong, choosing to remember her past her way.
芝麻油白菜心要吃豆角嘛炒
Sesame oil and cabbage heart. When you prepare string beans, you have to take out the string. If I don't see you for 3 days, I miss you to death. You're my dear, dear lover.
To try your hand at some of Sasha and Scott's recipes from the Cultural Revolution Cookbook, go to our website, npr.org. This is NPR's Weekend Edition, directed this week by Elaine Heinzman and produced by Peter Breslow, Ned Wharton, Claudine Abade, Gemma Waters, Hansi Lo Wong, Chris Benderev, Connor Donovan, Amy Held, and Jacob Margolis. Our interns are Andrew Fishman and Sam Collins. Barry Hardiman and Courtney Dorning edited this week. Our technical director is Burke Hun. Kim Oleski is our reference librarian. Melissa Goh is our web producer. Our show was produced today by Tom Bullock and edited by Deborah George. Our supervising producer is Sarah Lucy Oliver. Bridget Kelly is the senior supervising producer of Weekend Edition. I'm Rachel Martin.
The past 2 years have been good ones for pecans. So good, in fact, that from California to Georgia, there's been a spate of pecan thefts. Thefts worth thousands of dollars. It's all prompted Greg Davier to mount armed patrols of his pecan farm in Las Cruces, New Mexico. We called him to find out why pecan prices have risen more than 365% in just 2 years.
One of the major reasons for pecan prices being so high currently is our export market has increased significantly in the last 4 or 5 years, primarily China, but we've got pecans going to Europe, to the Middle East, India's coming into the market as well.
So why are they so popular in China? Do you have any idea?
I'm not an expert on it by any means, but they're primarily used as gifts during the Chinese New Year's. I'm told that when you bring a guest into your home, it's very customary to give them a gift. They're very into healthy foods, and pecans are the healthiest nut there is to eat.
In just a few years ago, it was something like 60 cents a pound. Now, I guess this year the price is something like $2.85 a pound.
It's been a very good year for us. We're price takers. We're not price makers. So whatever the price is what we have to sell our crop for. And especially with trees where you have to plant them a decade or more in advance of when you're actually going to be selling your crop, we're kind of stuck with whatever the market gives us. So when it moves up like this, it definitely helps us to get through the years that the price is 60 cents and we're all losing money.
And these high prices have caused you a big problem, which is why we called you, because people are stealing pecans. There are pecan thieves on the loose.
That's absolutely correct. The most common thing is people coming in literally in the middle of the night, shaking nuts out of trees, raking them up, and then taking them out in their vehicle. And it's in the thousands, probably tens of thousands of pounds, you know, every week that are being stolen out of pecan orchards. So it's gotten to the point now that many farmers, myself included, are having to be armed all the time. Farmers in general tend to face fairly low margins. And so if just 1% of my crop is stolen, it could be a third of our net income for the entire year. And so that'd be like someone having to have 4 of their months of pay stolen every year. It's difficult to overcome.
I read in an article you've been pretty vigilant. Can you describe what you've been doing?
We significantly increased our security. I have patrols that drive by our farm day and night. I have security guards that are on the premises overnight. And I've become just very unfriendly, unfortunately, during pecan season. When you drive onto my farm, we take a picture of your driver's license. We find out why you're there. And I just don't like being so unfriendly, but unfortunately I have to.
So what's the best way to prevent thieves from being successful once they've stolen the crop? You know, how do you prevent them from selling it?
Currently, there aren't really measures in place, and as an industry, we're trying to work with our legislatures, with law enforcement, with the district attorney's office to find solutions for this. We've talked about trying to license the buying stations so that if you're buying pecans, you need to have been approved by our industry. We know who you are, and you're not someone who's actively trying to buy stolen pecans.
All right, what's your favorite pecan recipe?
Oh, I'd have to go with pecan pie. I love pecan pie.
That's an easy one.
Yeah.
Not like pecan-crusted swordfish or something.
Well, I also like chocolate-dipped pecans. I like chili-roasted pecans.
Mm.
You know, I like all pecans.
I do, too. They're good. And thank you for harvesting them.
Oh, you're welcome. Eat all you want. We'll make more.
That's Craig Davier. He's a pecan farmer in New Mexico, talking about a spate of recent thefts in the area. Greg, thanks so much for being with us.
You're very welcome. I was happy to be here.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The school taco is getting a makeover. Today, the USDA released new school lunch standards. They trim salt, sugar, and portion sizes to make lunch healthier. First Lady Michelle Obama was on hand at an elementary school in Alexandria, Virginia, for a taste test. NPR's Allison Aubrey has the story.
As the First Lady slid her tray down the lunch line with a bunch of students at Park Lawn Elementary, she scooped up the brown rice turkey tacos, served with fresh salsa on whole grain flatbread.
This is so nice. It's so well prepared. Oh, I love it.
And she says this is what a meal is supposed to look like. Lots of color, lots of taste, but lighter on fat, calories, and salt. Talking to parents who'd gathered at the school, the First Lady says these new standards, which also mandate 2 servings of veggies per meal, aren't only about combating obesity. They're also about helping kids stay sharp mentally in the classroom, avoiding those mid-afternoon sugar crashes. And hopefully, she says, the standards will help reinforce the messages lots of moms and dads have been trying to drill into kids' heads about good nutrition.
When we send our kids to school, we have a right to expect that they won't be eating the kind of fatty, salty, sugary foods that we're trying to keep from them when they're at home.
More than 32 million kids participate in school meal programs every day, and advocates who've been pushing for healthier meals say this is progress, though the rules are not as aggressive as the Obama administration had hoped for. Margot Wu-Tan directs nutrition efforts at the Center for Science and the Public Interest.
It's a huge step forward. These new school meal standards will mean much healthier foods on our kids' lunch trays.
Even though the trays will continue to carry servings of French fries and pizza, Wu-Tan says the U.S. Department of Agriculture was not able to finalize a provision that would have restricted servings of French fries, nor were they able to cancel out a rule that allows schools to count pizza as a vegetable. On these issues, she says Congress and powerful food lobbyists prevailed.
Under the new standards, even though USDA wasn't able to do what they wanted to do around limiting French fries and not counting pizza as a vegetable anymore, there still will be healthier pizza in the school lunch.
It'll have a whole grain crust, be lower in sodium and fat, and it will need to be served with another vegetable. The USDA estimates that the price tag for new nutrition standards will total about $3.2 billion over the next 5 years, with many of the changes being phased in gradually. But Diane Pratt-Hevner of the School Nutrition Association says school food directors are already trying creative ways to win students over on healthier eating.
We're seeing more schools with salad bars and student taste tests and Harvest of the Month programs that they're really trying to encourage kids to expand their palates and try fruits and vegetables that they might not have encountered at home.
As for mom Alyssa Simmons, who attended the First Lady's announcement today, she says these new lunches, especially the 2 servings of vegetables, will be better than what she usually manages to pack for her son.
We're always so pressed for time. You just throw here and there, you figure one is good enough.
So Simmons says from now on, her son will be eating the school lunch. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Dudley Butler is quitting his job tomorrow. Never heard of him? He was picked by President Obama to run a division of the USDA. Butler was part of a group charged with exposing and fighting agribusiness monopolies, but he is the last of the group. Frank Morris of Harvest Public Media explains his mission and what happened to it.
Dudley Butler set out to change the cattle industry, a business cattleman Sean Meyer will tell you gets harder all the time.
Seems like the smaller go away and the bigger just get a little bigger.
More than 500,000 families have stopped raising cattle in the last 3 decades. Some say efficiency and economies of scale fully account for the decline. Others blame a revolution in the way livestock is sold. At sale barns, like this one in Kingsville, Missouri, cattlemen still bid openly for breeding stock. Meat packers, one spot on the open market, too.
But, you know, those days are over.
Steve Kay, the publisher of Cattle Buyers Weekly, says the four big packing companies now buy mostly on contract, a more sophisticated and efficient arrangement.
It rewards producers who produce the most consistent, highest quality cattle so that we can then produce more consistent, high quality beef for consumers.
Packers get a guaranteed supply. Cattle producers get a guaranteed market. That's good for everybody, according to Mark Dopp with the American Meat Institute.
That working relationship gives everybody some certainty and removes risk.
But it also removes a measure of independence, and that rankles some cattlemen. The system took hold in the poultry industry years ago. Now, fewer producers raise a whole lot more birds, and they work almost exclusively under restrictive contracts for packers. Fred Stokes, a Mississippi cattleman who runs the Organization for Competitive Markets, says beef is next.
We call it chickenization. Go the way the poultry guy is, where the farmer owns the land, totes the mortgage, does the work, but is under contract to someone who determines how much he's going to get paid.
And if that pay seems unfairly low, well, Stokes says there's not much a producer can do about it under the current interpretation of the Packers and Stockyards Act. This is where Dudley Butler comes in. A lawyer with experience suing poultry processors, Butler took over the Grain Inspection, Packers, and Stockyards Administration, determined to make litigation against packers easier. Stokes, a friend of Butler's, saw hope for the family farm.
I thought, my God, finally. It was unprecedented.
The USDA linked up with the Justice Department to launch a massive study of antitrust issues in agriculture, five big public hearings. Christine Varney was leading a freshly invigorated antitrust division, launching investigations and working closely with Butler. Now, Varney says she's sad to see Butler step down.
I think he is terrific. I think he's done a great job for farmers in America, and I think it's a great loss to the Department of Agriculture, but these are tough jobs, and everybody serves their time.
In fact, Varney resigned last summer.
This was the reformist team that was supposed to restore competition to the markets.
Bill Ballard runs RCAF USA, a cattleman's advocacy organization.
Now they are all gone, and we have seen no improvement whatsoever in the ongoing erosion of competition.
Now, that's not the way major meatpacking and livestock groups see it. They say what Ballard would call increased and transparent competition for cattle would have thrown a wrench into the beef industry big enough to cost thousands of jobs, millions of dollars, and significantly raise the price of beef. In the end, the House refused to fund implementation of the proposed rule change. So, after a long fight, the big meatpacking companies will keep their efficient production system, while smaller producers will continue to scramble for their place in the modern meat industry. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City.
This is NPR News.